Next speaker is a Matthew and Clinton. He will talk about tomato grafting.
Morning, everyone. Thank you for sharing your time with me this morning. I guess I'm a bit of a veteran of ASHS meetings, and so it's terrific to be able to renew long-time acquaintances and see fresh faces in the room. I'm here on behalf of my PhD student, Bijun Hu, and to represent her and her excellent work in basically in the area of pre- and post-grafting environmental effects on early phase healing of grafted vegetable plants, and most specifically her work in the area of developing a new protocol to assess the healing of those plants. Bijun is assisted in this work by her advisory committee, including Josh Blakesley, Mark Bennett, and Peter Ling, whose expertise is listed here. Together as a team, they and I think, are giving Bijun a really well-rounded experience and a 360-degree view of her healing protocol work. The work is sponsored in part through a USDA Specialty Crops Research Initiative grant and other smaller dollar grants that we've been able to accrue in support of this and related work. A propagation session, I would say 99.9% of the people in the room are very, very familiar with grafting, but just a couple of minutes to set the stage for the work that I'll describe to follow. In case you are not familiar, vegetable grafting is a process to splice two or more seedlings. In that process, we make a direct, physical, and more or less immediate hybrid. There are always two varieties involved, a scion and rootstock. We cut them. We discard half of what we've grown before, the roots of the scion and the shoot of the rootstock. We rearrange the two remaining pieces, and we combine and secure that graft somehow, and there are, of course, multiple ways of doing that. Okay. Now, we go to that trouble, and as both researchers and folks in the industry, we go to that trouble because the resulting hybrid is often a more vigorous or tolerant or resistant to abiotic and biotic stresses. And it may actually be more resource efficient as well, and by resource I mean water and or nutrients, for example. So overall, we would describe vegetable grafting as a process to make faster and more effective use of genetics in production. And for many of us here in the room, it's also a very useful process to test interesting hypotheses, not only to advance our understanding of how plants behave, but also to advance that understanding perhaps on behalf of industries that we work with, okay, commercial applications. Not surprisingly, just in the last 3 to 4 years, vegetable grafting has garnered a lot of international attention in the research extension community. I'll just give a few examples of that, of a symposium in Viterbo, Italy, nearly 200 researchers, 5 continents, 22 countries, a follow-up symposium held in Spain just this past year, symposium held in China this same year, 2 symposia, which a number of people in this room have had a hand in shaping and participated in, 2 symposia, one held in Florida, one held in San Diego. And at least from the standpoint of those 2 symposia held in Florida and San Diego, you can listen to that symposia, both of those symposia, online at this particular website, and also gain other information related to vegetable grafting. So, grafting has essentially 3 stages. We have to coordinate the production of both rootstock and scion seedlings because they must be roughly similar in their diameter at the time of grafting. Of course, we have to graft and splice them. That's essentially the least time-consuming stage in the entire process. And then the 3rd and final stage is the healing those newly grafted plants, making them ready for some sort of commercial use. And I'll be focusing on the intersection between the 2nd and the 3rd stages this morning. No matter how it's done, lasers, high-pressure water, razor blades, various cutting tools, there's no avoiding the fact that grafting creates very severe wounds. After all, we're decapitating both plants. It severs the root and shoot axis, and it will obviously disrupt root, shoot, transport, and communication. There's no getting around that because the seedlings are cut in half. And we have persisted in this process. I say we in the collective sense. We as researchers in the industry have persisted in this process, not necessarily having much more than a subjective way of assessing the health of the newly grafted plants other than to visually inspect them. And to this point, and for a long time forward, I'm sure that's going to be absolutely sufficient. The current protocol in Blue's making subjective ratings, and it has many attributes. It's fast, it can be very reliable, of course it's inexpensive, but it is inadequate for some applications. We can see a living or a dead plant, or we can see one that's going one direction or the other, but we won't, by that visual inspection, we won't really know what's going on or necessarily have the timing that we may require as scientists. And furthermore, if you do look at the healing process from left to right here, the newly grafted plants all the way to the right, that span may cover 2 weeks, 10 days to 2 weeks. And in that time, there seems to be a bit of a dormant, kind of quiescent phase where the newly grafted plant doesn't appear to be changing very much, and then all of a sudden it comes back to life. There's a healing, and then there's a resumption of growth process involved there. And it's our working hypothesis that this healing process is actually a continuous process. It's not discrete. It's not healed one day and not healed one day and healed the next day. And it's also our working hypothesis that if we had additional protocols to study that process, we would be better able to explain the G by E effects on it. For example, what does the pre-grafting seedling management and how does it affect healing and the resumption of growth? How about the healing chamber or the healing phase? We would benefit from having an enhanced protocol for assessing the health of the newly grafted plant. So it's been Bijan's objective to develop a quantitative protocol for assessing the timing and intensity, a return of these two factors that are listed here. First off, xylem flow above the graft union, and secondly, scion regrowth. Okay, that's been her main objective in this part of her program. So I'll describe the materials and methods real fast. We wanted to use essentially two different sets of plants that we felt or we expected to heal at different rates. And you can be the judge as to whether or not we were successful in that. The protocol was developed and tested using groups of plants exposed to different levels of light after grafting. All of the plants were Maxifort rootstock grafted to Celebrity Scion. And the zero photon, zero PPF on the left and the 135 PPF on the right. These are plants that were in the healing chambers exposed to those two levels of light. And then she used a rather sophisticated, if you will, but more direct observation of the scion and the rootstock condition. Regrowth was monitored at several points on the rootstock, as you see here, and the scion at 3, 5, and 7 days after grafting. And I've circled the points on the plant axis, indicating points A, B, C, D, and then the arrow is the graft union. A is the apical meristem, B is the midpoint of the scion, C is the midpoint of the rootstock, D is the soil line, and then the arrow is where the graft union was created. So we have those four points, and measuring from any of them to the other can give an estimate of the amount of regrowth that has occurred during the healing phase. So long as you have an accurate measuring stick and you have good eyesight, you can do this. And you, of course, marked your points very well. So this is just an example of that process. And here, this is Bijan's hand using a caliper to measure the diameter of the stem along that same axis at different points along that same axis as well, digital caliper. And here's where it begins to get a little bit more interesting, if you will. We also wanted to measure water movement, again, above the graft union or across the graft union. And for that, she used erythrocin B, which is a dye, and she exposed derooted grafted plants or control plants to that erythrocin B dye for 15 minutes. So you're seeing her excise a plant there at soil line, placing it in a container. Underneath that container is a small amount of erythrocin B solution. Sets the timer and lets it go. And 15 minutes later, pulls it out of that solution and very carefully completes an epidermal peel where it's obvious, the dye is obvious. Observation, I don't have a pointer I would show you, but you can probably see the red veins going up the shoot axis. Okay, longitudinal epidermal peels and also cross sections where you can visualize the vascular bundles pretty readily. Okay, this is just slight magnification. So again, with the grafting the pre-grafting treatments or the post-grafting treatments in the healing chamber, knowing various points on the shoot axis, and applying the stain, you can essentially measure the distance of the stain travel as a function of time. Okay, and then you can make various calculations based on those simple direct measurements. For example, with growth and diameters, you can calculate the total stain length to the total plant length and the total stain length to the rootstock length and so on. You can create a number of variables. So here are the results. The distance of the dye travel increased with time after grafting. This may not be terribly surprising. We do expect healing to occur. We're using tomato plants, and tomato plants can be grafted very reliably. So we were expecting the stain to move. What we did not know is how far it would move when after grafting. This is the bit of the protocol enhancement that we were trying to explore or exploit, because our visual assessments would not have allowed us to even get a handle on when water may be crossing the graft union. So 3, 5, and 7 days after grafting, she obtained a stain moving at above the graft union. It was actually absent at day 3. It was first observed at day 5, and then it was abundant at day 7. So again, we're drilling down a little bit more narrowly. When is all of this healing occurring? Without the painstaking, I guess I would say, structural botany, plant anatomy work of that was a little bit more common some years ago, but still being done, we would not know when that graft union became functional again, at least with respect to being able to transmit water or transport water. So we're using seedlings that were exposed to dark or just a 135 ppf light after grafting in the healing chambers. You can see on the left the plant exposed to dark had no stain above the graft union, and the plant exposed to light had some stain above the graft union. And the data points, although scattered, do bear out this trend pretty reliably and pretty clearly. The plants exposed to light resumed the transport of water across the graft union more readily and in greater abundance after grafting. So we used, comparing those same data, similar data to the control plants, which is the line across the top, of course, ungrafted. The stain was there right away, as you would expect it to be. And the dark ungrafted control, the light ungrafted control, we see that separation as well in terms of the amount of water transport as a function of the dye the amount of dye that can be visualized. This is stain length to rootstock length. In my personal opinion, in a session like this one, 12-minute kind of snippet of the project, it may not be as key to compare the rootstock length to the shoot length and those particular aspects. I'm hoping that the data are demonstrating to you that the dye is a ready tool to visualize water movement across the graft union. Okay. Rootstock stem diameter, relative growth, because she was measuring it with digital calipers at different points along the stem. The stem diameter data also reinforced the differential regrowth rates of both rootstock and stem of shoot as a function of post-grafting light treatment, shown here. Plant height relative growth, you know, we're seeing a lot more growth in the scion than we are seeing in the rootstock portion, as you might expect. And for the folks who are specializing in vegetable grafting and particularly the propagation area, they can appreciate how the relative regrowth rates of rootstock and scion may matter going forward, not only before grafting but also after grafting, because if there's a substantial difference in the two, we may end up with vascular connections that are not quite as robust as we would need them to be in field settings, for example. The graft length to relative length, this is the graft union to the meristem, bears this out again, and the importance of the post-grafting healing environment, light versus dark. And it's just a way to continue to explore these G by E effects. So, in conclusion, the dye protocol was capable of differentiating healing in groups of experimental seedlings. The distance of the dye travel varied greatly than the appearance of the newly grafted plant. So, again, recalling that our current and very effective and very reliable protocol is to assess visually the condition of the healed plant, but just with a visual inspection, living or dead. In this case, we're able to get closer to a description of the physiology, if you will, and more resolution in time. The implication of this is that the method may improve our understanding of the healing process and greater success and additional science, success on the industry side and science on our side. Now, you may say there's no way I'm going to be able to apply epidermal peels to, you know, thousands or hundreds or dozens of experimental plants. And we would agree with you. the Imperial we would agree with, Bijan would agree with you, okay? Person having done all the work. It is still quite reliable, especially if the number of your plants is relatively small. Still quite reliable. So our next steps have included spectroradiometry, which can quantify that dye moving through the stem very rapidly, by position. It's very sensitive, and it's non-destructive, so we don't have to destroy the plant to take the reading. So spectroradiometry is very appealing to us for those reasons. Spectrophotometry is also appealing to us for another reason. You know, it's also highly quantitative. It's destructive. You can take the samples, freeze them, and stick them inside, and then when you have more time, take them out and collect your data. And the cuvettes shown here exemplify that. You know, from very clear to slightly pink on the right, she's been able to begin to develop a standard curve, if you will, for the amount of dye in the stem at different points. So spectrophotometry and spectroradiometry are very, very appealing to us. And if there's any time, I'll be happy to answer questions.
Let me have one question.
Josh.
Matt, how do you think this would change if you used a non-leaf removal technique? How do you think your results would change if you had a leaf removal versus non-leaf?
Sure. Good question. I think Josh picked up on the clear fact that we tend to trim our scion aggressively before we grafted, and so our grafted seedlings initially had very few leaves and very low evapotranspirative demand. So if that were to change, if we were to not trim as aggressively, I think the results would probably not, the fundamental result would possibly not change, but the speed or the timing may change, okay, because clearly that evapotranspirative demand is there now if you do not have a trim scion. But given the production of growth regulators in the shoot and those possible effects on the healing, it may differ. So on those grounds. So all right, thank you.
Very much.
Yep.